following A2A one-on-one feature is a production of the nonprofit Adversity to Advocacy Alliance. The views and opinions expressed by our guests do not necessarily reflect those of A2A or advocates, allies, or ally organizations. We hope you'll find this interview both informative and inspiring. And now, here's our host, Liz St. John.
Alan Lux coined the phrase helpers high and wrote the book The Healing Power of Doing Good. He's considered one of the top experts on volunteerism and how helping others can benefit one's emotions and physical health. Alan Lux has been involved in nonprofit and public policy for over four decades. He worked with the Alcoholism Council of New York, followed by the Institute for the Advancement of Health. In 1990, he became the executive director of Big Brothers Big Sisters of New York City. Lux, who has a law degree, established the Center for Nonprofit Leadership at Fordham University, the first center sponsored by both a graduate school of business and graduate school of social service. He served as its first director and now is director emeritus. Lux also suffers from Parkinson's disease and has written about its impact on his life. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
How and when did you start your research into the idea of the healing power of doing good?
Well, like all helping, someone helped me. I had been in the Peace Corps. After the Peace Corps, I practiced law for a while in East Harlem. And I always tell people, I really feel good doing this. They say, why do you do that? Go get a regular law job. Do something that's accepted. You make too little money and you work too many hours, etc. And I was going to a conference with a man who passed away, T. George Harris. Brilliant man. He was the editor and founder of Psychology Today and American Health Magazine. And I was, again, talking like I talked to other people. He was driving the car, and he said, well, then write an article for my magazine. But do it now, Alan. You have a week to do it. I said, a week? He said, yeah, there has to be, I'll have a lot of research. And he pushed me, and he called me up, where's the article? People need pushing. And I finally put the article, gave the article into him. It became very spread out, Reader's Digest picked it up, it became a national article. And based upon that, it was based primarily on my experiences, we did a study of 3,000 people who did help others. And we found that people who help others, they are 10 times more likely to say they feel good about themselves and that the health benefits they have came after they started helping. That's the critical thing. And I started on this route. People began to call me up. I began to do more research. We had to call other people. And finally, in the year 2007, it was just me doing this research. It wouldn't be that exciting. In 2007, the federal government brought together all the research that was then available and concluded that people who help others live longer. That's the actual quote. People can get that study on healthy helping by the Center for National and Community Service in Washington, D.C. It's nothing that you probably don't feel, but here it is, the federal government saying you will live longer. We can explain why people who help others have less stress and do have better health.
Well, you are taking me exactly to my next question, which is about all this research that's been unfolding over this past 10 years about the healing effects. So tell us about some of that research. What types of experiments? How are the results measured?
There have been so many, many, many studies at leading hospitals, the leading universities. University of Michigan study took people with MS, and they had a problem being mobile, getting to people that they helped, but they helped people either on the phone or they were able to get to see the people they helped. And they compared this group of MS patients who were helpers against those patients who weren't helping. And the MS patients, multiple sclerosis patients who helped, felt much better about themselves psychologically, but physically were much more mobile. It doesn't mean that helping others is going to eliminate, unfortunately, MS. What it does mean is that you get a relief, or the helpers say they get a relief from pain. They get a relief from their immobility. They have to become more mobile, etc. And there's studies like this over and over. And what the researchers at the hospitals have found, and not just in the United States, throughout Western Europe, have found is sort of something like meditation. People meditate and they feel better, they feel calmer about themselves because the world of stress is being pushed away. And the helpers is doing something very similar. While they're helping others, they're getting feedback, they're getting smiles, they're getting hugs, they're getting kisses, they're getting thank yous, they're getting handshakes. And this pushes away the stress from work, the stress from family, the stress from just the outside environment. And people record less stress. And we know stress is a killer. Stress exacerbates pain. Stress makes you feel much more weaker. And so the research has found if you can help others on a continual basis and do a lot of helping. So it's not that easy to do. It's not easy. This helping will reduce your stress. And as the federal government said in all the research, you will live longer.
Well, so it sounds like evolutionary biology set us up, set our brains up to help others, which would help us as a species continue. Is that what we're finding? You help others, you do feel better.
Yeah, as one of the researchers said, the fire outside the cave would have gone out unless we all could continue as cavemen to help one another. We'll bring it up to today. We need the helping. We need the helping. So we were programmed, we as human beings were programmed to help others. But then you have society coming in, and the society says, do this, do that. You have this responsibility, you have this task. And you have to do those too. So how do you find enough time to do both the helping part and your other tasks? And the studies show, and the federal government brought up this, I had the same conclusion, ironically, and the federal government study showed you had to do about 8 hours a month. That's a lot of helping. But those people who did about 8 hours a month, 2 hours a week, were the ones who recorded less stress, ones who recorded feeling better about themselves, ones who had all the, let's say, all the indices for not having stress-related issues such as high blood pressure, elevated sugar, exacerbation to pain, inability to sleep.
So it's interesting if we say, okay, so it's nature that we are set up to help others. We certainly see it in a crisis. We're recording this interview on September 6th, so we just experienced what happened along the Gulf Coast with Hurricane Harvey, and people were running to help others, even putting themselves in danger. And we're watching as Hurricane Irma is making its way towards Florida, and the governor is calling for volunteers. We need volunteers, and people are running again to volunteer. So we see it in a crisis. And maybe the thing we need to get in our mind is this needs to sustain, as you're saying, a certain amount of hours in a non, you know, just on a regular basis.
Yeah. In the research I've done, we coined the phrase, which is now used really in all the research throughout the world, called help is high, because so many people who help others on a regular basis, this 8 hours roughly a month, and had critical personal contact with those they helped, almost all of them were recorded highs that almost were like runner's highs, and so we call it the help is high. And that help is high has now come into the literature. So you've got to push yourself initially. It takes time to push yourself. I'm going to help. And if you do it, most of you, 90% of those people who do it will get connected to the helping act, the helping benefits, and will stay with it. But it's hard to push yourself. It's easy to speak on a phone. It's easy to tell other people. But you got to push yourself. I volunteer. One of the volunteers I do is in the churches and synagogues in downtown New York during this winter for the homeless. We make some dinner and we give them some shelter, some beds for the night. And there's two people do it. And very often the perfect person who's my partner who's supposed to do it doesn't show up. I got to call at the last minute, get someone else. And I'll start calling frantically around. And my friends will say, who wants to sleep overnight in the shelter for the homeless? I said, just try it. And almost all the people who try it stay with it. The problem is most of the people turn me down initially. So you have to keep pushing yourself. I was listening to your listeners. Try it. It's so easy today to volunteer. Type in volunteering, the kind of volunteering you want. It might be a health issue. It might be an immigrant issue. It might be an issue of whatever the issue might be. And start to try to do some helping of others. See if you get that help aside. 90% of you will. If you keep doing it for about 2 hours a week, 8 hours a month, you're going to get that. And the research, you can look it up. It's there. You'll have less stress, feel a wonderful sensation of yourself, the light sensation, the pushing away stress. And the nice, great, great thing is you live a little longer.
I agree with you so wholeheartedly. I've interviewed people from nonprofit organizations for decades now, and that is the one of the common threads is the volunteers. So many volunteers come in and they say, well, I'll come in, I'll help these other people or help these animals or help the environment. And then they come away thinking, wow, I can't believe how good that made me feel. I feel like I'm getting more from this than the cause or the person that I'm helping. So it seems to bear out.
Yeah. One caveat for the people listening is I'll tell you a little story for my book. The two women went to a nursing home. Both women were in their late 50s. And they sat next to a bed. They read to the people in the nursing home. They talked. They patted each other's hands. And afterward, one friend says to the other friend, that was the greatest thing I ever did. I felt so good. I'm going to keep on coming back to this home. And the other woman said, it was terrible. I couldn't stand the smell there. I felt depressed. I'm never going back. Helping is not for me. But it's not true. If you can look at the research, it says that if you try a helping act and it's not for you, you don't like that one, it simply could mean that the nursing home environment is not for you. There are thousands of other ways to help, so give it another try. I'm raising my right hand, I'm swearing to you, all the research shows, give it another try. Well, people, we meet someone, and some of us like another person, some of us don't like another person. It becomes that we all react differently. So if you try helping, and if you find that helping isn't that one helping assignment isn't right for you, try it again. Try it several times before you give up on it. You were meant to have that helpless high, that feel-good sensation.
I know many public high schools, in order to graduate, you have to do X amount of hours of volunteer work. And I think part of their thinking is that these young people will get in, volunteer because they have to, and at least some of them will find, oh, I actually like that, and then continue that as a way of life. I don't know if we start talking to kids at a younger age about volunteering, do you think we should? In what ways do you think we should weave this into our school system, maybe our businesses, our government? What would you like to see done?
Well, the research is quite clear that those individuals who started helping at a younger age in a school environment, but more, even better is that the family encourage them to volunteer at the family. They will stay with it as adults. Though others who first start to help others as adults, it becomes a little harder for them to begin. So families out there who want to get people involved, you want to get involved, you get your children involved because it's so important to them, they should try to start out as a family. And also it helps the youngsters, the teenagers are so self-conscious, for example, adolescents are self-conscious. It gives them this support to try to help other people. And I know my family, part of my family lives in Houston, Texas. They think miraculously, were not affected by the storm. But they had their kids, who were only 7 and 5, handing out food in the shelters. And the kids at first were, I would say, uncertain. Should they be doing it? What am I doing? Why am I standing here? But they began to do it, and they began to say thank you, and they said to say good luck. And it became part of them, and they had this big smile on their face at the end. So if you can volunteer as a family, try to do it. Volunteering, required school volunteering is good too. Just the research shows that the family volunteering is something that stays with you much more.
You do have Parkinson's, and of course you continue your work. How do those two intersect? Are you doing any particular work around that disease?
Well, thankfully, I've had no side effects of it, but it's going to come. I can't beat out the disease. But yes, for example, I go boxing. One of the research shows that Tai Chi, boxing, social dancing, where we do coordination. But the other thing besides doing coordination is that we help each other in the sport. So the boxing that I go to is also men and women, primarily in their 50s and 60s. None of us look like boxers, nor do we act like boxers. But this whole question of helping each other when we box, we support each other, we yell to each other, we say, go get them, is a way to feel good, a way to help each other. Yes, I'm doing something to help my fellow Parkinson's patients.
You've accomplished so much. What are you working on right this minute? What next big goal do you have on the horizon?
Well, the biggest thing that worries me now is I'm on my last laps. I'm not a youngster anymore. I'm horrified by in our country how we're so divided. What can we do? We have the fastest growing group, the largest group is seniors, this group I'm in now. They are the group, they want to make their last mark as needed in this country. They're the ones who have to get involved and say, we will bring people together. So I'm trying to work on a training program with seniors that would get them to volunteer much more in government, whether it be at the local level, state level, or federal level, where they can go out from the different officials and speak to the people in the community, get people in the community involved, get people in the community saying, even if you disagree with somebody, we can all come up a way with a compromise. We can compromise. This division of people not being unwilling to compromise is a horror. And seniors have the ability, the fastest growing part of the population, and they want to have their last mark, their last marker on this road. At least I want to put that last mark on, they want to write one, is to make this society a much more cooperative society. So I don't know how far I'll get, but that's going to be my last lap.
All right, and I want our listeners to know they can get more information about Alan, his books, and his continuing work at alanlux.com. Thank you so much for joining us today, one-on-one.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to A2A One-on-One, an outreach project of the nonprofit Adversity to Advocacy Alliance. To listen to other one-on-one interviews and to learn more about A2A, please visit us online at a2aalliance.org. And thanks for helping us spread the word that we help ourselves by helping others.